Joshua, themerrimack.com. It's 9:07, and this is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Last week, the Obama administration announced a dual-agency federal task force aimed at a rising threat to American agriculture, the decline of the honeybee. And to those who might think this isn't a matter of national concern, the White House offered this reminder. Honeybee pollination enables the production of almost 100 commercial crops, ensuring we have fruits, nuts, and vegetables to eat, and adding $15 billion to our economy. In addition to honeybees, the task force will focus on other pollinators, such as birds, bats, other bees, and butterflies. The effort includes $50 million to be spent on deeper study of why these creatures are struggling and incentives for habitat restoration. But while the news was welcomed by many in this field, some said it wasn't enough. They want tougher, more immediate action, especially when it comes to reducing pesticides linked to honeybee death. Today in The Exchange, problems with pollinators. Let's hear from you. What have you noticed in terms of bees and other pollinating insects and animals? What more do you want to know about the role they play in the food we eat? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our Facebook page is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests in studio are Barbara Lawler, president of the New Hampshire Beekeepers Association. Her apiary is located in Bow with about 15 colonies. Barbara, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me here.
Also with us, Sandra Rehan, joining us from UNH. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Biological Sciences. She also directs UNH's Bee Lab and leads research on native bees in New Hampshire. And Sandra, it's good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we talk about what's happening to the honeybees and the other pollinators that I mentioned, Sandra, if I could get into some real basics with you, what does a pollinator do?
Okay. The pollinators vary. We know honeybees are really one species, but we have probably about 250 species of other bees here in the state, and birds and bats and other flies. And all these insects and mammals, they will go around and visit flowers. In doing so, they collect nectar and pollen, and the pollen that sticks to their legs can actually be transferred from one plant to the next, cross-pollinating. By depositing pollen, is actually fertilizing each other and spreading around genetic variation between the plants and creating healthy crops as well as wildflowers. And so not only do the bees take the food for themselves, but they're also providing the pollination service or the kind of spread of gametes for the flowers and the crops as well. So it's kind of an accident on their part, but they're actually providing a nice service for the flowers.
Well, a nice service, but a vital service, right, Sandra? I mean, I know we should all remember this from high school biology, but just remind us why pollination is so important.
Well, they won't produce the fruits if they aren't pollinated. So without their services, the pollinator services, the yields, you know, may rely on wind pollination or other services that aren't sufficient and aren't far enough for the crops and plants to actually produce viable fruits. And so, yeah, it's a vital service in that without these insects visiting and depositing pollen, they simply don't produce those yields that we rely on for our food sources, as well as sustainable plants and ecosystems.
So you have apple trees with no apples? Is that what happens?
Right. So, I mean, there would be some, but there wouldn't be nearly as many. Without the introduction of pollinators, there is very low yields. And without, so pretty much without the insects, without the pollinator services, we simply wouldn't have the food. And it's estimated that 1 in 3 bites of food are actually provided by pollination service. So a third of our food relies on the service, and so without the pollinators, we simply wouldn't have most of the food we see in the markets.
Okay, so 1 out of every 3 bites, and I've heard that. So give us an example. Let's say this morning I had for breakfast, I had raisin toast and a banana and some peanut butter. So which of those bites can I thank the pollinators for?
Certainly the peanut butter, the nuts, pretty much all fruits, nuts. Grains are typically wind pollinated, so the bread could have happened without the bees. But yeah, pretty much a lot of the fruits, nuts, a lot of vegetables too, all the squashes and melons, and apples, blueberries, cranberries. I mean, there's, as you said, about 100 commercial crops, almonds, peanut butter, peanuts, most of the nuts and seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds. The pumpkins. I mean, there's just, if you went to a market, a third of everything in there is going to be because of pollinated crops.
Well, and Barbara, we hear that the honeybee is the most, by far, prolific pollinator. What makes honeybees so good at what they do?
Well, honeybees that's all they do. They are designed to, when you hear the phrase busy as a bee, that's exactly what they're doing. The honeybees don't sleep. A worker bee will live for 6 weeks approximately, and she spends her life going through a variety of jobs, about 2 weeks as a forager, so out doing exactly what Sandra just spoke of, pollinating. And when we speak about pollinating crops, Sandra mentioned almonds. For a two-week period, the almond crops bloom. That's the window of opportunity for these pollination services.
It's not very long.
It's not long at all. And to understand, some of what I'm sure we'll speak about further, and to help people understand a bit more about pollination in general, the almonds are grown in a space about the size of Rhode Island in California. It's a monoculture. That is, all that exists are almond trees. So what happens is at the point when they need to be pollinated, approximately 80% of the United States bee population is put on a truck and migrated to this location. They're lined up, and at that point in time, as soon as the bloom happens, the bees get out and forage, and they create this pollination so that you and I can have all the almonds that we want to eat year-round.
Do you send your bees to California to pollinate almond crops?
We don't. We are hobby beekeepers. So with about 15 colonies, we're just happy to have them right where they are. We may take a colony or two to a local orchard, but we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of bees that get put on a truck and driven across the country. And it's big business. It's about a $15 million business. So it's really vital. Not only that, the bees, while they're there, are eating only one kind of pollen. So they have to be dropped off before the bloom, and they're picked up right after the bloom. So trucks and truckloads of other pollen are brought in and dumped down the middle of the rows, so the bees have something to consume so they can stay alive and stay healthy enough to pollinate. So then all those bees move on to the next crop, whether that's blueberries or apples. So really, the way we've chosen to grow our food so we can have the quantity of the food that we want, almonds as a great example, require the bees to be taken. And why honeybees? At this point, I think honeybees, because of their very nature, are easy to keep in a colony. They're easy to keep in a physical structure. They're easy to move. I'm not sure that would necessarily be as easy with dragonflies or bats or a whole lot of the pollinators that we have out there.
I'm imagining you corralling a bunch of bats and shipping them across the country. Sounds like a little bit more of a difficult task. But you raise a question I want to ask you, Sandra Rehan. So today's modern industrial agriculture, where we have monocrops, as Barbara put it, in one specific place or in a bunch of different places, raise the question for me, what did the Native Americans do before, colonists got here and set up this system of agriculture? Did the wild bees do all the work?
Yeah, that's correct. The honeybee is actually an introduced species from Europe. So prior to the early 1800s, we really didn't have honeybees in North America. They're not native to the area. So wild bees have lived here for thousands, if not millions, of years, and would have provided pollination service for all of the native crops and the native peoples long before honeybee was around. So the nice thing about the native bees is that they've co-evolved with these plants, so they're well-suited to pollinate, and a lot of them are, in fact, specialists on certain crops, so they're really well-tuned. Some plants can't be pollinated by honeybees. For example, tomatoes require vibration to release the pollen, and that's a service that can only be provided by bumblebees. So there are certain crops that actually are better off with the services of native bees because they've co-evolved to provide these services, and the floral morphology is actually so specialized that only a native bee can provide these services. So, yeah, the native bees have been around for a very long time.
Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join our conversation as we look at what's happening to our pollinators is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. What more do you want to know about the role that bees and other pollinators play in the food we eat? And given the concern in some parts of the country about declining bee populations, what have you noticed on your own garden, in your own backyard? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Barbara Lawler, quickly back to you. When I was asking you why honeybees are so good at pollinating, you used the word she. I thought the worker bees were he's.
That's a common misconception, especially if you look at the bee movie and some of the other media that's out. All of the workers are in the hive, so they are female. There are three castes. There's one queen. The queen has developed ovaries, and she is the only bee in the hive that actually lays eggs. And when she is in full force, as she should be right now, she's laying somewhere between 1,200 and 2,000 eggs a day. She doesn't sleep. She doesn't leave the hive to eat. She is fed. She is cleaned. And that's her job. The two other kinds of bees in the hive are worker bees. So worker bees are female bees that do not have mature ovaries, so they cannot lay eggs. And they go through approximately 12 different jobs, from cleaning the hive to receiving the food when it comes in, the pollen, the nectar, and putting that away, to tending to the queen. They can be guard bees, so they're guiding the hive and protecting the hive. And then there are drones, and drones are male bees. Drones do not have a stinger, and drones serve to impregnate a virgin queen. And other than that, they eat up the stores and just hang out all day long. So the workers are all female.
All right. We will learn a lot more after a short break. And take your calls to join us, 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. The Exchange is coming to the North Country. You can join Laura Kanoi and a panel of experts as they talk about the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. You can attend the special event at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem happening July 10th and reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. Partly to mostly cloudy today. Chance of afternoon showers and thunderstorms. Highs today, upper 70s to the mid-80s. Mostly cloudy tonight. Chance of evening showers and thunderstorms. Lows tonight in the low to mid-60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from the Monarch School of New England, expanding services to meet the needs of students with significant disabilities. More about the Monarch School at monarchschoolne.org. And Goodwill Industries of Northern New England, seeking solutions that work in creating sustainable communities where nothing goes to waste. Not a shirt, not a shoe, not a person. GoodwillNNE.org. It's 9:20. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today in The Exchange, threats to bee populations and other pollinators and what it means for American agriculture. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. What have you noticed in terms of honeybees and some of the other pollinators we're hearing about, from birds to bats to butterflies? Also, what questions do you have just about what the role these pollinators play in our food production? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Barbara Lawler is with us, president of the New Hampshire Beekeepers Association, along with Sandra Rehan, assistant professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UNH, where she also directs the Bee Lab and leads research on native bees in New Hampshire. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Barbara and Sandra, before we go to our listeners, Sandra, I did want to ask you first. Okay, so there's been a lot of concern around the country recently to the plight of the honeybee and what's called colony collapse disorder. Where is this, Sandra, and where is it most severe?
Well, the colony collapse disorder has been reported actually globally. It's not just a North American problem, but also a European problem. And so far, I think Australia's been safeguarded to some extent, but there's evidence that they're also not doing as well. The colony collapse is a kind of a complex issue where we're not really sure. It's called a disorder because there's not one cause and not really a deep understanding as to exactly what factors or in isolation or in concert are actually leading to the decline of the honeybee. So a lot of the work that Obama and other agencies are trying to address is really what are these factors and is it the same thing nationwide or is it more localized? And so there's a lot of research going on and needing to be done to really establish best practices and how to move forward.
What have you noticed in your own field research, Sandra?
Well, I actually don't study honeybees. So
sure, you're studying the wild bees. I just wonder what you've noticed, though, about their health.
Right. I think all pollinators are not doing well. So it's beyond colony collapse disorder. It's beyond any species-specific problem. It's really kind of a global problem, a national problem, in that all insects aren't doing well. The pollinators are kind of a keystone species we can look at to see habitats that aren't really functioning and aren't healthy. So we're noticing in the native bees, especially here in northern New England, that species that were here 50 years ago, a lot of them simply are no longer. They've been completely extirpated from the area, and some have gone extinct. So we have species that were very common and simply are disappearing, and it's hard to know exactly why they're disappearing. A lot of conjecture as to land use practices and this idea that monoculture is not really favoring bee health, that they need this variety of pollen, that they need wildflowers. So there's been movements to plant wildflowers and have unmowed pastures so that the bees have this variety in their diet so they can retain healthy immune systems and can combat environmental stresses. So, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done, but we're noticing that all native bees are also changing. Some species are doing okay, thankfully, but some species certainly are not. And so the work we're doing is really to establish for the first time here in New Hampshire what bees we have here in the state and how they're doing and what is the effects of land use and agriculture on these native bees. Because right now we simply don't have this information available to us.
So if a species of bee dies out, one of these wild bees that you study, Sandra, you said earlier that it's kind of cool in nature, actually. Each bee or each insect has its preferred fruit or vegetable that it pollinates. Let's say species, you know, A dies out. If species A was the chief pollinator of raspberries, for example, what does that mean for the raspberries? Does somebody else take over or do they struggle?
Well, some species have a lot of pollinators that visit them, so some bees can be generalists or specialists. So if you have a generalist species, it visits many flowers and many kinds, and so it can fill in some of those kind of niches or fill in a bit, but some are specialists, and so if they disappear, they might be providing a lot of the pollination service for that particular crop or that particular plant. So if that species becomes threatened, that could be very bad news for those crops. So it varies, and unfortunately we just don't have a lot of data to know how this will play out. And unfortunately we just see declines, but it's hard to, there's probably more species going extinct than we knew existed.
Wow, Barbara, I love your thoughts. Before we go to our listeners, colony collapse disorder and the broader health of bees in this country.
Well, I think, you know, as we listen to Sandra, something that people don't understand, we think about honeybees and pollinators for fruits and vegetables, but we haven't even touched on the medicinal properties. And that's where I think this is key. When Sandra speaks about a particular pollinator that is a specialist for a particular flower, if that flower does not have pollinators, it's very likely that flower would become extinct. And we've seen that happen. If that flower becomes extinct, and that flower is or that tree has the key to curing cancer, we really lose some opportunity. The Manuka tree is one that has a lot of great properties. It's pollinated by honeybees, but it could be any pollinator. That that plant itself has some great medicinal and healing properties, and when used in concert with certain chemotherapy drugs, speeds recovery. It kills cancer cells much faster. So when I look at it, you know, I love almonds, and that's great. But if I never eat another almond again, I'll be okay. When it comes to losing the opportunity to use these plants to cure some of the diseases we have, to make ourselves healthier, that's where I start to get a little bit more concerned.
Sure. And, you know, a lot of people take herbal supplements and so forth, maybe not for something as serious as cancer, but a lot of people swear by different herbs that they take to improve their lives and their health. So you're saying there's a connection there with the bees.
Absolutely. And not just the bees, it's the other pollinators as well. We really face the same battle in making sure that we've got a variety of great food and forage available for our pollinators. And that's where the public can help. That's where you don't have to be a beekeeper or a scientist, but by learning what plants and flowers to plant, by learning how to treat them, by learning about pesticides, you know, that's where we can all make an enormous difference.
Okay, and I want to ask you definitely a little bit more about that later. What plants and flowers bees particularly like and other pollinators, because I know that'll be interesting for our listeners. But let's go to our listeners now. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Kathy's waiting in Chesterfield. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I'm curious as to how our agribusiness, GMOs, Monsantos of the world, how that affects, with their sterile seeds, their connection to the natural pollinators. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Kathy, thank you very much for calling in. Sandra, do you know anything about this?
So we are concerned. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of information available on the native bees and the Monsanto crops, but anytime there's these massive monocultures, it's dangerous, and sterile monocultures would be, it's just a, makes a big void of habitat, really. So it's not that those crops don't rely on the pollination, but they provide a huge landscape of an inhabitable region for native animals, really. And so you're creating, just as one could pave a large interstate or, you know, clear a huge forest, this is the same kind of practice, really. You're removing any possibility and habitat for these animals. And so, yeah, it's definitely something we're concerned about, because you're removing the habitat and on species that are already declining. If you then replace their habitat with uninhabitable areas, then you're really doing them a further disservice.
So it's all this habitat disruption that we've been talking about, whether it's monoculture or what you mentioned earlier, Barbara, just paving over places where there used to be flowers and fields and so forth. So let's say I'm just an average person. I'm not a beekeeper. I'm not a farmer. I'm not even really a gardener. But sure, I want to help out. What should I do?
Well, there are a host of things that you can do. Certainly, if you are, do you do any kind of gardening, buy any plants, you can take a look at, as our earlier caller mentioned, where the seeds come from. Are they coated in some kind of a chemical or a pesticide that certainly will make that plant healthier, but impacts everything around it? For example, there's a class of neurotoxic pesticide called neonicotinoids, or neonics for short, and those are actually chemicals that are sprayed on seeds, and the seeds are treated. So when the seed grows and sprouts roots and has a plant and flower, it's a systemic pesticide, so it goes throughout the entire plant. So whether it's a pollinator that lands on it that's beneficial, or whether it's an insect that you're trying to keep off that crop in order to keep that crop growing well, they're going to be impacted and bring back trace amounts to the colony.
Interesting. So it's not a spray that's on top of the plant and you know, maybe washes away somewhat with the rain. It is in the seed and in the plant.
It's systemic, absolutely.
And neonics, I think, as they're called, are pretty upsetting to some environmental groups. Go ahead, give me a little bit more if you could, Barbara. People feel like these are not good for the bees.
In 2013, the European Food Safety Authority actually labeled neonicotinoids as an unacceptable danger to bees, and they've been banned in several European countries. We are taking a look at data in the U.S. and certainly hoping that with the recent focus on pollinators and pesticides, that we will definitely have some movement in that area to make sure it's safer for all of us.
Well, and in Science Magazine, Sandra, I was reading that, yes, the Europeans have banned neonicotinoids, but the Australians say they use neonics and their bees are fine. So what's your take on how much pesticides, especially this one, are to blame?
Like Barbara mentioned, I mean, we're in need of desperate need of data. So some of the work we're doing here is actually addressing this empirically. We're looking at agricultural practices that are organic versus conventional farming, which really heavily does use neonicotinoids here in the U.S. And we really just need strong evidence to support or refute these claims. In Australia, they've benefited from a lot of the pathogens and viruses haven't reached that continent yet.
It's so remote, yeah.
Right. So, I mean, their bees may be okay for now, but as soon as their health is in jeopardy in conjunction with these neonicotinoids, they don't know. They may be a year or two away from experiencing a lot of the colony collapse disorder that the U.S. and Europe have been experiencing. So to say that these chemicals are not affecting their immune system and their health, I think would be perhaps naive, given that they haven't experienced some of the declines.
Some of the other stressors that our pollinators have faced.
Right.
Let's take another call if we could. Thank you for that one. And Brittany's waiting in Dunbarton. Hi, Brittany. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
So my question, actually, you guys just cover a lot of it, but was in regards to the neonicotinoids. I'm a little backyard beekeeper and have had many troubles over the last 5 years, but you know, I think more related to some of the climate issues and cold snaps and that kind of thing. But my question is, could somebody speak to how what we have for data? How do the neonicotinoids affect, you know, actually inside the colony, a honeybee colony? What is sort of happening in there when those neonicotinoids are brought back to the colony? And then also, I have just recently read something that there's possibly a connection with the Varroa mites and the use of neonicotinoids, and that, you know, if the bees are already weakened by the pesticide, are, you know, the Varroa mites just sort of coming in as a next sort of, you know, symptom of that? So that's my question. I was wondering if anyone could speak to those connections and that process of how the neonicotinoids work inside.
Sure. Brittany, thank you. I'm glad she mentioned the mites, because that's something else that comes up a lot. Barbara, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. Well, by way of a little bit of biology, a bee has an exoskeleton. So a skeleton is on its outside. And mites were introduced to the U.S. in 1980. And prior to that, the bees didn't have a lot of issue. We certainly had some foraging issues and deforestation, but not what we've seen after the 80s. So what a mite does is it attaches itself to a bee, and it bites through the exoskeleton and sucks on the hemolymph, which is what we'd call the blood, for lack of a better term. Bees can actually live with a certain number of mites very nicely.
Moose can live with a certain number of ticks, but once it reaches a critical threshold, then it's trouble.
Exactly. The challenge that we've had is that the mites carry viruses. And years ago, there were just a couple of viruses, and we're now up to almost 28, at last count, viruses, several of which are still yet unnamed. So it's not so much the mite, it's that once that mite population gets too large with the viruses that they carry, then the bees end up being weakened to a point where they perish. And to introduce the neonicotinoids, anything that is going to weaken that bee any further is going to make it much more susceptible to those viruses. What happens with the neonics or any pesticide or anything that the bee comes in contact with on their wings or their legs or their feet, they walk around on the honeycomb. Well, comb is like a sponge. It sucks up everything. So now the queen will go ahead and lay an egg in there, and that bee will emerge and be exposed right from egg to maturity.
So it's already, it's like the eggs are being laid and the baby bees are being born in a contaminated environment.
Certainly not the healthiest environment, absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, Brittany, and good luck with your bees. Let's go to Sylvia in Florence. Hi, Sylvia, you're on the air. Go ahead. Oh, we lost Sylvia. Okay, Sylvia, I hope you call back. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. You know, Sandra, you mentioned a minute ago the Obama administration, the $50 million and this new federal task force between the USDA, Department of Agriculture, and EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. So what are your best hopes for this $50 million and how the administration is going to spend it?
Okay. Well, we hope that they invest in not only looking at honeybee. We hope that they also look at the other pollinators and that this is something we can take kind of more holistic approach to sustaining healthy pollinator services. We hope that the work will look at each of these factors, not in isolation, but we know that they're all involved, as Barbara mentioned, that the neonics can then be confounded by the mites, can be confounded by a lot of other factors. So we need to start looking at this more holistically and not only from the honeybees' perspective, but also the native bees are also being affected and other pollinators. So some of these common problems, including, you know, land use. I mean, this is something we need to consider the effects we have, not just blaming the chemicals and the imported or introduced viruses and mites, but what are we doing and what can we do to improve bee habitats? And I think more research in that line is very necessary so that backyard enthusiasts, gardeners, farmers can all make change. We need to act now. So if we can have best practices and good policies in terms of planting wildflowers and not maybe having huge monoculture, which we know is not great for the bees' immunity, and maybe diversifying our crops some, or at least introducing wildflower borders, we could very much make active change because we know policy is slow to change. So right now and in the next few years, we can do a lot of good while this research is ongoing. And this funding certainly helps us scientists to develop best practices and protocols. But there's a lot of things we can do now, which should be great.
Okay. We will talk more after a short break. I'd love to follow up with you too, Barbara, on that, especially Brittany's point about cold snaps, climate issues, and so forth. We'll take more of your calls too, so stay with us, 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Supreme Court largely upholds the EPA's right to regulate power plant emissions. Then, attorneys David Boies and Ted Olson behind the scenes on the legal fight to overturn California's same-sex marriage ban. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from German Auto Works in Concord, servicing Volkswagen, Audi, and now BMW, welcoming technician Jody McCormack with 16 years BMW service experience. Details at 228-2834. And Greystone Farm Assisted Living and Memory Care, surrounded by natural woodlands in Salem, New Hampshire. Tours may be scheduled by visiting Greystone Farm at salem.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, problems with pollinators. Concerns about honeybees and other pollinators are taking center stage in Washington. President Obama announced a new initiative just on Friday to further study what is happening to our pollinators who are so important to the health of many of our commercial crops. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. What do you want to know about the role these pollinators play in the food we eat? And what have you noticed in your own garden, in your own backyard, in terms of bees and other pollinating insects and animals? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Barbara Lawler, Sandra Rehan, before we go back to our listeners, Barbara, I wanted to follow up with you also on Brittany's call. She's a backyard beekeeper, I think is how she put it. And she said she's had other issues, climate change, weather problems, cold snaps. What has the extreme weather meant for bee health? Well, whether that's a heat wave or a cold snap.
Exactly. And again, we have to go back to data to be able to have some sort of baseline from which we can understand. And NASA actually collects data from beekeepers in order to track climatological change.
Really?
So they do. And we're looking for pollen and nectar because that's a great indicator of what's happening in the overall climate. For example, in the last 80 years, they're finding that average plants flower about 9.5 days earlier than they used to, that the bees are active on about 11 days earlier, but that blooms are 8 days fewer. So a bloom is out there. So we have a compressed time frame. The insects are starting earlier but flying for fewer days. And all of that has to do with our climate. This last year, the cold, the prolific cold that just lasted forever, the old-time cold that those of us who've lived in New Hampshire for almost forever remember, did a job on our honeybees, and I would suspect on our other pollinators as well. With a honeybee, they stay awake and alert and active inside the colony during the cold. So they keep the colony at about 50 degrees. They do that by detaching their wing muscles, their wings from their wing muscles and shivering the muscles. But they do need to get out of the hive in order to defecate. And many of them couldn't do that in the long, prolonged colonies. And we had significant colony losses this year. They already run about 30% across the country year over year. But this year, it was significantly more in the Northeast because of the cold.
And the predictions by climate scientists at UNH are for a wetter New England in the years ahead. So what is that going to mean for bees if there's more days where it's just raining really hard?
Well, honeybees certainly don't fly in the rain. So they're not going to be able to go out and perform these pollination services. In addition, we're going to have a difference when bees, when the flowers are available, for how long the nectar is viable for them. And that's going to affect all of the pollinators. And I would have to say I agree with Sandra as far as our hopes for the money. And, you know, certainly we have a vested interest in honeybees, but it's all pollinators. We really need to attack this much more holistically.
You mean when I say the money, the $50 million yes. that the Obama administration is putting forward to this. Let's go back to our listeners. Gerald's calling from Enfield. Hi, Gerald. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Yes, I have a question about growing plants in hothouses. What are the limitations?
What are the limitations, Gerald, in terms of?
You don't, if your hothouse prevents pollinators from getting in there, does that mean you can't grow plants like that, or can you just leave a vent open and they'll come in?
Yeah, leave the windows open. I guess it depends partly on what you have in there, Gerald. But Sandra, what do you think?
Like as Laura was saying, what you're growing will be very much important if you're trying to grow tomatoes or squash or cucumbers or anything like that. Certainly they will benefit from and require pollination services. I know some people actually bring in bee boxes, so you can actually commercially acquire bumblebees, and so you could actually have a bumblebee colony right in your hothouse. So I'm not sure, but we can provide the information on the web in terms of where one can purchase that. The introduction of depends on the crops, really. So if there's any interest in and more of the common fruits and vegetables, then the introduction of a bee box would be probably a very good idea and would increase your fruit yields.
Do you provide those services, Barbara, or do other people in your group, the New Hampshire Beekeepers Association, provide a bee box to someone like Gerald who's got a hothouse and wants to have things grow productively?
Well, there's actually a research project that we're entertaining doing with a very young, up-and-coming young lady who wants to do some research on bees in tunnels, which is exactly what he's talking about. But I think what Sandra's talking about is more the pollinators that are going to be applicable, like the bumblebees, maybe even mason bees. So the kinds of other pollinators that are going to take care of those crops. So we don't do that, but I'm sure we're happy to point people in the right direction.
Yeah. What does the New Hampshire Beekeeper Association do for either backyard beekeepers, commercial beekeepers, or people like Gerald or others who, you know, just want to get a little help from the bees? What do you guys do?
Well, there are seven clubs across the state, seven local clubs, and we are made up of a president of each of those clubs and the executive board, and then we serve the members of the state in several ways. We've helped to work on legislation. Because certainly there are beekeepers that want to be able to keep bees in a variety of locations. And it's helping the planning board and the zoning board and the people of the town understand the perceived dangers and the benefits. In addition, you know, we try to get folks to understand that they've got beehives on top of the hotels in Manhattan. So you don't need to have acres and acres of fields, but you do have to be responsible. So we work with beekeepers to understand sustainable, reasonable practices so that they can maintain a safe apiary. Again, working to bring in scientists and speakers from all over the country in order to speak to our beekeepers and anyone who would like to come and listen to educate.
Probably, yeah, following up on a lot of the research that we've talked about and how there's so much more that we don't know about what's stressing bees and other pollinators. I'm real interested, though, in what you said, Barbara, about you work with local planning boards and cities and towns on responsible beekeeping. Do some beekeepers find that they want to expand their operations and the local town says, no, no, we don't want those bees, we don't want people to get stung, or what are you talking about there?
Absolutely. And there are real fears. No one wants to get stung, right? As soon as you mention
bee. Some people are allergic.
Exactly. But when we hear allergies as well, we tend to think of anaphylactic shock, the kind that if you don't get to a hospital immediately is a terminal event. But most people, if they have any kind of a reaction, it's not a full allergic reaction. We still want to be responsible, though. So the other thing is lots of times people are not stung by a honeybee. It's some other kind of a bee. And when you're stung, I'm not so sure you're interested in what it was that stung you. Just you've been stung and it hurts. So we do work with zoning boards and planning boards, and we were recently able to work with a local city who had a very restrictive policy and help them understand and provide them with data and information. And as such, you can now very nicely keep bees in that city. And also help them understand what are some reasonable guidelines as far as how much space should the person have, where should the bees be located. The other piece we do is provide swarm collection services. So you can go to any of the local websites or to the New Hampshire beekeepers if there's a honeybee swarm, and we will certainly do everything we can to get someone out there to get it removed and remove any kind of nervous threat you might have about it.
All right. Well, let's go back to our listeners. And the phone number again for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Waiting in Alton is Tim. Hi, Tim. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Good
morning.
I've been enjoying your show this morning, and I would like to thank the New Hampshire Beekeepers Association for being able to put this program on with you.
Did you have a question for our guests, Tim?
Yes, I do. I have a question and a couple of things that I've heard that you say. 10 years ago, we used to put bees out around Memorial Day. Now we have to put them out around the first week in May. So the climate has changed, and we have about a three-week opportunity to pollinate our wild blueberries. And one of the things that I'd just like to bring up, the farmers a little bit in a squeeze because we like to practice the IPM program. And we do not like to spray at all, and we don't do it unless we hit the certain thresholds, because we have to put out a decent product. People don't want worms or anything else in the blueberry, so there is a drastic shortage of native bees. Years ago, there used to be all kinds of them. We have to bring in, we have to rent hives at 10 years ago, around $15 to $25 a hive. Now, this year, we paid $135 a hive to have them come in.
Wow, more expensive than. Yeah, hey, let me. I could just jump in, Tim. IPM is, Barbara, Integrated Pest Management. So what does that mean in terms of bees and how Tim runs his wild blueberry farm?
Well, it sounds like what Tim does is what a lot of beekeepers try to do, and that's introduce as few chemicals as possible by manipulating your colonies, manipulating the bees, using some specific hardware, some specific boxes that allow things like the mites to drop through, allow additional ventilation, which will keep the bees healthier, and only use chemicals, whether they're soft or hard chemicals, when absolutely necessary.
Yeah, and he also mentioned, you know, wild bees, Sandra, and now he has to bring in commercial bees. 20, 30, 40 years ago, could New Hampshire farmers, small-scale farmers like our caller, just depend on nature to do its to do the job of pollinating?
About last year, there was an interesting study came out looking at the native bee assemblage, looking at northern New England, and suggesting that there has been dramatic declines, especially in bumblebees, which are wonderful pollinators for crops like blueberry. So many of these species have vanished or been extirpated from areas, and other species, like I've mentioned, have actually gone extinct. So they simply cannot provide the pollination services because they have been in such rapid decline. This is very much a real issue. We unfortunately don't have a lot of data for the state of New Hampshire. So, I mean, this is my first year here in New Hampshire, and our lab is working very diligently to try to establish a baseline of what species we have and how they're doing so that we can track and help prevent further extinction events and extirpation of local populations. So we really do need to get a better sense of the native bees across the state to better help people like Tim and the blueberry industry.
Well, Tim, good to hear from you, and good luck with your blueberry crop this summer. Let's take one more call if we could. This is Francie in Peterborough. Hi, Francie. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks. In Route 202 North was widened a couple years ago, and New Hampshire Department of Transportation planted an amazing wildflower mix, lupin, coreopsis, black-eyed Susans, and it was mowed a couple weeks ago, much to the distress of, there were two letters to the editor and lots of people talking about it. I wonder what efforts there are to have a good mowing policy along our median strips and roadsides, because that's where, by default, a lot of wildflowers, that's the best place for them.
So, Francie, DOT planted these.
A wonderful mix.
Yeah.
It's available. It's pretty expensive. And I talked to the local I talked to quite a few people at DOT. And I think there's hope next year that they're not going to mow this particular strip. But I think it's bigger than Peterborough. I think it's statewide. And, you drive along the big roads, and there's a lot of blooms going on. And to mow in June, especially bloom time, I think is more coordination.
Yeah. Thank you very much for this call. This is real interesting. I want to hear from both of you on this. Go ahead, Barbara.
I would say, Francie, what we're seeing here is something that we see throughout the entire pollinator gardening issue, is just a lack of information. So I can tell you I don't know that area specifically, and I don't know what kind of orders came down to do that, but they had to have been done by somebody who just did not understand the impact of the choice. And we see that constantly. We are not understanding the impact of whether it's the pesticide that we're using or spraying for mosquitoes or what we're planting or not planting. And we need to get people educated. And it's very exciting to have somebody like Sandra here and a bee lab. I just learned of it fairly recently. Have not yet met Sandra. Looking forward to having her speak at New Hampshire Beekeeper sometime soon. But, you know, these are the kinds of things we need to do, is educate people so that they understand the impact of those choices.
Well, sure. And I'm sure the policy has always been, whatever, every X months or X years you mow. And somebody didn't understand that that could have a big impact on the bees, which are having impacts on blueberry farmers like Tim and so forth. You know, on the happier side, Sandra Rehan, I did see the other day going up Pleasant Street here in Concord. This is a very busy street for people who don't live here. Just your usual crummy roadside patch of grass. suddenly transformed this year by beautiful wildflowers. It was lovely to look at. I thought it had to be good for the bees. Somebody had clearly done this. Somebody had put up signs saying, please don't pick the flowers. So it looked like a very deliberate effort. How much do you hold out hope that that will happen, Sandra, that more and more people will just take, you know, little crummy patches here and there alongside the road and plant flowers for the bees?
I think there's a lot of hope. Like Barbara was mentioning, I think a lot of the problem is just the lack of education, the lack of information. And so being new to the state, my job is really to educate and to share this information. So if every person planted wildflowers in their backyard, one person may think they have no voice, but really, if we all start doing this, I mean, that could have a very dramatic impact, that these urban and suburban areas would become very healthy pollinator communities and very healthy habitats. So this isn't just an issue for agriculture and statewide initiatives, but each citizen, each person has the ability to plant flowers and make sure that their yard is actually conducive to bee habitat.
Yeah, it's tricky, though. We did a show on ticks a couple months ago, Sandra, and everybody was saying, mow your lawn, mow your lawn, mow your lawn, keep it short so the ticks don't thrive.
Well, yeah, the ticks, it's a compound issue. So, yeah, but I mean, you can mow the place for maybe where your children play or where your dog would go, but you could definitely have a cornered off area for which the wildflowers can grow to a certain height, and you just... You know, if you fenced it off or just put up a retaining wall and you're not going through it, the ticks aren't going to come at you from meters away. They're going to, you know. So the nice thing with a tick is that it's a terrestrial and it kind of gets on people by contact. So
stays there is, put.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really they're not flying at you. So there is certainly ways to mediate that. If you have small children and pets that you're worried about the ticks, certainly keeping a divide between your wildflowers and those would be very advantageous. But if you're not running through the wildflowers, then, I mean, you probably shouldn't be doing that anyway.
Right. Well, Sandra, thank you very much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Sandra Rehan, assistant professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UNH and director of UNH's Bee Lab. Barbara Lawler, it was really good to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Barbara Lawler, president of the New Hampshire Beekeepers Association. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our intern is James Pouliot. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Every weekday morning, we bring you an exchange of opinions, left, right, center, and sometimes directions you never considered. We bring you an exchange of information, what you know, what we know, and what the experts know. It's our goal to keep you informed, aware, and in tune to what's happening across the state and around the world. I'm Laura Kanoy, inviting you to lend your thoughts to The Exchange weekdays at 9 a.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Beaver Productions presenting Michael Bublé in concert at the Verizon Wireless Arena in Manchester on Friday, July 11th at 8 p.m. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. And the Center for Dermatology and Cosmetic Care and Dr. Guardiano providing Mohs Micrographic Surgery at Cheshire Medical Center, Dartmouth Hitchcock Keene, CheshireMed.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Proponents of the EPA's role in regulating heat-trapping gases associated with climate change are calling it a win. Others are not so sure. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that the EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. The ruling only applies.